When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
These data brokers, you know, we should try and figure out what they're doing, essentially selling personal data, predicting my future, just like weirdly accurate.
Madhu is the first artificial intelligence editor at the Financial Times. She has a ringside seat to seeing what some of the most exciting companies in the world are doing. But her new book, Codependent, goes much deeper than that. She crisscrosses continents and countries, looking at the impact it's having on real people in their day-to-day jobs. It's a fascinating read. She's a techno-optimist, but is aware of the risks that AI brings. The book has already been listed for Women's Non-Fiction Prize. Madhu started her career having studied biology at the University of Oxford, but has gone on to write for Wired and the Financial Times. Madhu, welcome to Jimmy's Jobs of the Future.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the book. What was the origin story for Codependent? Where did it come from?
So it really came from Carl Risonak, who you've probably never heard of, computer scientist in the US, who in the 80s built like computer vision systems for the US Navy to try and kind of navigate submarines. And he was one of the pioneers of facial recognition algorithms that, you know, that he developed that were used to catch criminals and find missing children. And so he really kind of believed in the positive impact of this technology. But also, Carl is African American, you know, he's black, and he'd found over the kind of his lifetime or his time of his career how much the technology had changed and how it was now being kind of twisted and weaponized against people who looked just like him by police in the US. And he knew that it was not ready for prime time in that way. The technology was flawed and made errors more frequently on darker faces compared to Caucasian counterparts. And so this kind of terrified him. Mm. And it was this kind of really fascinating question of a moral dilemma within an individual person who's been responsible for creating a technology that they're now kind of worried about the consequences of it. And I just was fascinated by that from a storytelling, you know, perspective. And I thought his story is a symbol of how AI has changed so quickly within one person's career of 20 yeah. years, and how it's gone from being something that was, you know, being tinkered within a lab to something that's being used on people all over the world. So I wanted to kind of bring that global story to it.
And you start the book by talking about sort of 10 years ago when you were kind of in the early foothills of your career, about going and using one of these data companies to find data out on you. How did you feel doing that, and how has it moved forward in the next 10 years?
Yeah, so that was actually, it was a great idea from an editor where often they don't get enough credit. But David Rowan, who was my editor at Wired then, he was like, you know, these data brokers, you know, we should try and figure out what they're doing. And at the time, I didn't even know what a data broker was. Mm. And it sounded really boring. And I was like, really? But I started to kind of dig into who they were. And, you know, they're really murky kind of industry of companies that are essentially selling personal data. But for me, it was about kind of how do they fit into the wider internet economy? And and I wanted to personalize it. Again, it was clearly kind of evident that I, for me, human stories are what bring these kind of larger issues to life. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to find out what they know about me, and I went away. And I remember the profile that I eventually pieced back together from all of these data sources was just like weirdly accurate. And not just, you know, what I look like or where I'm from, but things like, she shops at Sainsbury's, but only because it's on her way home.
Yeah.
Which is, says something very specific about you, right? You don't have loyalty to a particular brand. And it was predicting my future of like what kinds of behaviors I would, what kind of career I might have. And so I found just that was so startling to me that through kind of piecing together a bunch of data, you can actually create a coherent picture about a person. And that for me was the start of the AI kind of journey.
And it badged you as a bright young thing.
Yeah,
right?
Back then.
And back then, yeah, exactly. It'd be interesting now. But, and there's 64 different types of profiles they give people. Do you think that it almost knew more about you than you did in some ways, in some areas? I mean, not obviously in all the sort of nuances, but were there things that kind of surprised you when you read it, like the Sainsbury's thing, for example, being like, yeah, that is true?
Yeah, no, definitely. There was the other one was, she has a cleaner who lets herself in while she's at work.
Wow.
Because you know, you can guess that because I'm like, you know, single, living in a rented flat and a working professional, so I'm probably not going to be around when my cleaner comes in. And
yeah,
it's probably easier for that to be done while I'm away. So it's just, you know, having specific data points. They really surprised me because they were often true.
Yeah.
And it's not because they knew that about me or there were cameras in my house. It was just about being able to predict what somebody's life and personality is like, just based on sort of disparate data points. And I think that is the foundation for the current modern era of machine learning also, right? That's the power of it.
And one of the things you do great in the book is you go to these 8 countries and you kind of crisscross the world, and I love books like that that kind of take you to these places. And it's interesting because you see it through the eyes of other people, right? And we're not very good at doing that necessarily. And it really struck me how this is already changing lots of jobs out in different countries anyway. Sometimes positively, giving people a lot more agency, giving people ways of making money, but nothing compared to Silicon Valley. Like, how did you go about sort of like deciding where to go, and how does the research happen for something like that?
Yeah, that was, so for me, it was really important that I don't spend time in Silicon Valley for this book, because that's all we ever kind of focus on, you ever see getting written about this. But if the promise of AI is that it's going to change all our jobs, all our lives, all over the world, and for me, this was, you know, bear in mind, this was 3 years ago, I was like, okay, where is it already happening?
Mm.
What does it look like today? Not the future, the kind of amorphous future, but today's AI technologies. So for me, the first thing was trying to get the geographic spread, you know, what does it look like in Latin America? And so I found the story in Argentina. What does it look like in India, in Kenya, in China, and so on? And then I would kind of find people who are willing to talk to me about their moral dilemmas and how it was changing their personal lives and that of their community. For me, that was key, you know, to get their stories deeply told. Because when we talk about how is AI going to change our jobs, the fear is because it feels like you don't understand, really. It's very kind of big picture. It's like, oh, it's going to replace customer service, or, oh, it's going to be able to write stories that journalists can write. But I wanted to know, what does that feel like to have your job be able to be done by a technology, and kind of get that into the book. So I spoke to data labelers, gig workers, you know, and voice artists as a sort of example of three very different jobs, and kind of wanted that to show how culture interacts with technology as well.
Can you tell us the story of the Uber Eats turned Uber Cheats person? Because I thought this was brilliant.
He's often a reader's favourite character, actually. He is just a mad guy. He's called Armin Sami. He's Iranian-American by birth, and his whole vibe is, you know, if he thinks something is unfair, he does whatever he can to go out and fix it, and that might be the smallest thing, like a vegetarian aisle being labelled vegan, and you know he felt that was unfair and spent months fighting and getting the local county health council to come in and change the supermarket kind of sign. So he's always been somebody with a lot of innate agency to change his circumstances. He's a computer scientist too, and he'd kind of worked in tech. He worked at Argo AI, the self-driving car company, and he decided he was going to take a break from that, and in between jobs decided to be an Uber Eats courier because he'd moved to Pittsburgh recently and wanted to see the town and loved biking. So he was on his bike doing Uber Eats deliveries, and he basically suspected that he was being underpaid. And now this is really hard to do, right? Because it's so opaque, these algorithmic systems, particularly in gig work, around what your payment should look like. There's no equations. And he only suspected it because it showed a distance that he traveled, and he felt that he'd actually traveled a much longer distance. So he created this browser app.
Feels like me on my Strava running as well. Oh God.
Yeah, what were you like?
I definitely ran further than that.
That's how he felt, because it doesn't tell you the GPS coordinates.
Yeah.
It just shows you the route for privacy reasons of what you've done, and it basically just prints a number saying you've gone X kilometres or miles, and therefore you've been paid Y.
Yeah.
And he was like, that doesn't look right to me. And so he managed to extract GPS coordinates from the JPEG image and figured out that he'd actually had traveled a lot further, and he made that into a tool, a browser kind of tool that anyone could access with their receipts. And thousands of workers around the world, from sort of Tokyo to India, were able to kind of figure out that they were being consistently underpaid. So he didn't have a reason. He didn't have a class action suit, or he didn't kind of activate anything, but he just wanted this as a kind of way to be transparent.
But what struck me about that story was that he's undoubtedly an incredibly talented guy in lots of ways, right? To be able to build that Uber cheat system and upload it and so on. But essentially is that, you know, he's trying to argue with the AI essentially and isn't getting anywhere. And it just strikes me that this is the danger with a lot of it, is that it's just stripping out all these middle jobs. And so the whole kind of like shop floor to boardroom principle is basically just disappearing in front of our eyes. And actually somebody like that, who's clearly got loads of skills that can be valuable to Uber Eats in lots of different ways, is just being passed over. And I just think that's where there's a real danger, that AI isn't going to improve productivity, isn't going to improve social mobility. In fact, it's going to, you know, there's a danger that it makes it all worse.
Yeah, I think that, so for him, the big problem was there was no human he could get on the phone.
Exactly.
To essentially just say, we made a mistake. You know, it took him 120 minutes worth of phone calls, hours, and multiple emails to eventually get a human to kind of acknowledge this.
Yeah.
And I think this comes up again and again, wherever you see AI, you know, implemented in the economy, whether that's at, you know, in a white collar desk job, or whether that's kind of in public services, where, you know, you have lots of kind of public sector using AI to kind of determine various whether somebody should get a service or not. And in all of those cases, when you sort of don't have a human, not just in the loop, but who somebody can talk to on the other end of it, that, you know, you end up become feeling very distant. And therefore disempowered, I think, in your own work or your life.
Do you think, with all your experience of the Valley and studying this kind of on a daily basis, these companies, that they're undoubtedly run by incredibly clever people that have a high IQ, but that sort of EQ side of the emotional intelligence is missing on a lot of these companies, and they don't realise the impact that they're having?
I think that when any company becomes very large, it becomes a bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are factions and fiefdoms and people trying to keep each other happy. And I've been reporting a story recently where it's not that the individual people don't have EQ, and maybe, you know, that, and I don't know if this is scientifically proven out, but maybe computer scientists are less gifted on the like empathy side. Maybe that might be the case because of kind of how they work, right? But I think the bigger issue is not that individuals don't have empathy within these corporations. It's more that the larger it gets, it becomes, you know, the system moves on its own, and you kind of lose sight of what's important, whether it's the user or the citizen or whatever that, you know, or your employee for that matter.
Yeah.
And things start to just sort of run on their own, and it gets worse. So that, I think that is the issue with a lot of the companies building AI today.
And you talk about sort of the scarlet letters as well and the sort of impact. And I thought this was like a great example of where, you know, trying to spot people who may end up committing crime, etc., but they actually end up naming the people and going to them directly and not anonymizing it, is kind of a classic example of where people are trying to do the right thing, but they end up sort of miscuing it a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was an example of Amsterdam's city council, mayor's office, essentially creating a statistical algorithm that would find, you know, which children and young people would go on to commit crimes. And the reason for doing that was to then provide those families with help, right? So it was a good intention, and it was supposed to be sort of a form of public responsibility and care. But what ended up happening is when you involve the police, things become coercive. And the cultural elements to that were there was, you know, racism in the police force against North African immigrants, which a lot of who live in Amsterdam, they started to feel kind of targeted, isolated. And so a kind of project that was meant to help these people in particular, help them integrate, help them to be strengthened and empowered, had the opposite effect. And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily just the dystopian idea of having a list of children who are going to commit crimes. It sounds a bit crazy, but I think, you know, if you can have a list of families that require help, but that they are actually kind of helped and seen as part of the conversation rather than here's a letter that tells you something bad is going to happen, it could have had a very different outcome. And I think that's what the, you know, Amsterdam is trying to do now. They're trying to include parents more in the conversation. They're not using predictive technology anymore. And to me, that just sounds like, you know, good policy making ultimately. And I'm not sure how AI plays into that at all. So this is often the problem, that there are human manual solutions to many of the issues, but because of our kind of techno-solutionist tendencies, we kind of think, oh, AI can solve that, when it's quite obvious that you could do that the same with social workers or doctors or whatever, you know, whatever the case may be.
You describe yourself in the book as a kind of techno-optimist. So to try and sort of like touch on some of the optimistic sides of it, like where are the most interesting applications and positive uses of AI that you've seen on your travels?
So I focus on healthcare in particular as a kind of really potentially life-changing a way in which AI can play a role. And I think, you know, having seen how AI has impacted on scientific research in the area of health, but also on healthcare itself, like diagnosing diseases, you know, whether that be COVID, tuberculosis, lung cancer, breast cancer, countless examples, peer-reviewed research now that shows AI can play, you know, really positive role, especially in economies where there is no access to care. You know, here in the UK, we're struggling with, we don't have enough radiologists in the pipeline to solve this problem ever.
Yeah.
It's not enough to just keep training more people. We need something to augment that. And I think that AI feels very promising in that area if we can do it right, if we can maintain the agency of the human doctors, because, you know, it is ultimately healthcare. It's a human endeavor. You don't want your diagnosis to be broken to you by, you know, an app.
Yeah.
If you've got breast cancer, for example. So, you know, there's a key role for the tech to play, but it has to be done obviously alongside all of the human capital that we have. But I'm very hopeful about that. But even in the job space, right, like I do write about data labelers, content moderators, gig workers, and there are some really kind of stories of disempowerment in many cases, or kind of opacity between algorithms and their creators and the employees on the other side. But in many cases, these are jobs that wouldn't exist without the technology. They are kind of uplifting people out of, in many cases in my book, you know, extreme poverty. With gig workers, often they're migrants and so on, who are making a living. I spoke to quite a few Uber drivers in Nairobi who felt, you know, who kind of loved what they were doing as an alternative to driving a Mutatu or a bus or a motorbike. But that doesn't mean that it's not flawed. And for me, that the book was to lay out the reality of what that looked like, even though it was having positive impact.
And one of the jobs that I wanted to ask about that you talk about at the end of it was the Franciscan friar, which is a job that I'd never come across before. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah. So he's a priest. He's a Franciscan priest. But, this I had to learn this as well. I'm not Catholic. They don't only work as priests. They're also trained in different areas. So his name is Paolo Benanti, Father Paolo, and he lives in a friary above a small church in Rome, right in the center of Rome. And the others who he lives with are, philosophers, mathematicians, musicians who teach. So their vocation is to teach. And so he was a technologist and technology ethicist, actually, who did a PhD at Georgetown, came back, and he now teaches at the Pontifical University in Rome about sort of ethics, morality, technology, and biology and how those intersect. But he's also the Pope's advisor on AI and how it's going to impact society more widely. And I wanted to end with that. And I think for some people, it was like a bit of a surprising kind of direction to go in right at the end, right? But I wanted to kind of take a step back and look at all of the different voices in this story, people you wouldn't expect, but people who come in with very different perspectives and priorities in this conversation. And I went to a signing of a charter on AI kind of ethics between, the Catholics, the Muslims and the Jews, represented by leaders of the faith, who kind of came together to kind of agree that that humanity should be valued above anything in an AI world. And for me, it felt symbolic of kind of where we were going. But
it's
unexpected.
But it's a terrific end to the book. People should definitely read that bit and the depth you kind of go into in the conversations, because it's it is amazing to kind of think about that and how kind of humanity and human skills are going to be still required in agreements and so on. But it was I hadn't realized it all happened and so on, so you paint a very kind of vivid picture of it. I wanted to ask you about the sort of job of a journalist and so on, and one of the questions that we ask people is, if they were starting their career now with all that they know, where do they think they'd be heading and so on. Now, as AI editor at the FT, I imagine that you would probably be following a sort of similar kind of path, but what is your advice to young journalists wanting to kind of get into the AI and technology space in particular?
I just had a young reporter from another paper just asked me that earlier today. So I think, I can imagine that it's scary entering a journalism career at a time when it feels like AI can basically do much of your job.
It's only what you would start out doing.
Exactly. Because when you've done it for 10 years or 12 years like me, you understand what sets a good journalist apart from an average one. And I think that's what, as a whole, as an industry, we've got to figure out, right? What are the things that AI can do that is kind of useful for our readers and we should and can use it for? But where are we adding value? And I think that there, the big thing is humans who can go out and find stories that don't want to, that others don't want to be told. What are the hidden stories, the kind of repressed ones, that those are the most interesting, joining the dots. And you need to have the curiosity of a person going out into the world to come back and say, I think this is a story. Because what good journalists do is recognize what makes a good story, because somebody's going to read it and respond to it. So I think we need, you need to be, that's what we need to be training young journalists on, follow your nose and hone that skill of trying to sniff out a good story, not just the obvious, what are the big companies doing? Because there's a lot of access journalism as well in tech, but the companies have become so much more powerful in the decade I've been doing this job, and they now do decide who they speak to and who they don't, as is, I guess, their prerogative. So it's hard as a new journalist to kind of get in there. But I think there are ways to do it without having access to Sam Altman, or Sundar Pichai or Satya Nadella to kind of look at how the technology is affecting those around them, not just people, but companies, startups, yeah. investors, and you can tell the stories from the outside. And I think that could sometimes be the best stories.
You describe like the job at the FT as sort of adding a dose of realism to things, which I think is a really interesting phrase. How do you do that in a world that can be so often like overly optimistic with things? Like how do you sort of root yourself in that realism?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, that you have to talk to not just people in Silicon Valley. It's like the
yeah,
only...
Or just people in tech, yeah.
But just, yeah, I mean, but even people in tech outside of California have different views. When you look at entrepreneurs in Europe or investors in Europe, they come with a much more realistic view about things and also different priorities. Broader areas of interest and often are kind of much more connected in with the policy space or even civil society journalism. And so I think it's about diversity of sources to get out of the bubble of the valley. Sometimes, you know, obviously it's amazing when you go there and you're part of the ecosystem and the environment, you know, it's filled with stories, filled with interesting people, but it can help to be outside of that. You know, I've always been based in London where you kind of get to dip in, but also get to talk to academics and activists and others who have their own expertise. And that, for me, it's how I've kind of found a way to tell, you know, make my interests sort of FT-fied. You know, and kind of bring that to FT readers where we might not have otherwise covered, you know, surveillance, biometrics, even AI.
Yeah.
You know, a few years ago, it was something I was one of the maybe two or three people who were interested in it. But to say this matters.
What was your route into it? Because you studied biology, right, at university, and then you became a sort of technology journalist at Wired. So how did that jump happen?
Yeah, so after biology, I also studied clinical immunology, did a master's in that and worked on vaccine design. So I've always been like super kind of fascinated and interested in science and health and medicine. But the best bit about it was always telling other people about what we were doing or the promise of it or kind of communicating that with others. And I think when you practice as a scientist, it's very lonely. And you have to be so committed to kind of work on one small slice for so many years in order to be a good scientist. I don't think I would have been a good one because I kind of was always interested in the context and wanting to kind of take it broader. So I decided at that point, I'm going to try to be a storyteller, a journalist about complex topics like science and health and kind of see how that went. And my backup plan was I'd just go and be a doctor if all failed. And I'd just try it for a year. But it worked out. And I think that's what I do today is kind of break down complexity.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what I love doing.
What did your parents do?
My mum was a teacher, an English teacher, actually. My dad was a chartered accountant, so worked in business. But he did, so most of the latter half of his career, he worked in media buying at Unilever. And so it was really fascinating to see how his role changed so much. Because in India, where I grew up, it was all about TV and kind of TV advertising and brand. And then when we moved here and as the internet changed, you know, he would go visit Snapchat HQ and like come back with swag. And he's really kind of witnessed and understood the digital shift in his work as well. So I think I've kind of been fascinated to see how things have changed even for him in the 10 years.
The process of writing a book can be sort of very cathartic and provide lots of insight into your own career and so on. Where do you see the next 10 years heading in journalism, and like what are the broad sort of trends? I don't want to say predictions, but try and paint a picture of where we're going to be heading.
It's really hard. I think everybody's trying to, you know, figure out in media what happens to journalism. And we've seen quite sort of high profile layoffs at the LA Times, at the Washington Post, you know, stalwarts of journalism. So it feels like, you know, a period of incredible change coming up. I think what it's going to look like is there will be a whole bunch of sort of AI generated stuff littering the internet, where you're going to have sort of it content produced by this at scale. But equally, people already are starting to mistrust that content, right? You know, you're not sure if something is real or fake. And at the moment, it feels like even you know, mainstream media outlets, legacy media, whatever you want to call it, like, are in that sort of position of having to prove that what they're, you know, that they're telling the truth.
Yeah.
And often some of the kind of harshest critics come from the tech world when it comes to kind of how they're portrayed in the media. And I find that really quite concerning. But I do think that, you know, as more and more stuff floods the web and people start to realize that this, you know, that there is an AI generated content space, that there will be a value in and trust in, you know, organizations using humans to check facts and to report what they believe is true to the best of their knowledge. And I think there's an opportunity for us to then say this is the role that, you know, responsible, high quality media outlets or the press plays in a world where anything could be fake, right?
Yeah, that's really interesting. What would be your dream job if you took money, social inhibitions, etc., all out of it? What would your dream job be?
So we had an internal chat about this recently, and I think I have the most boring answer because I would do what I'm doing now, which sounds so lame because it's like someone else was like, I would just like take all the money and, I don't know, have a party planning company. but for me, the perfect job would be 6 months as a journalist, 6 months, right, working on a larger project like a book.
Okay.
And this is where I'm at today. But, you know, recent conversations I've had around sort of how this plays into policy and how you can govern and empower people. I'm like, I've never been kind of interested, you know, personally in politics. And as I said, I didn't grow up here. I grew up in a very different, I grew up in India. But I'm curious about how AI is going to change how we all live as citizens and whether I can kind of strengthen my understanding of like the role that policymakers play in that. So not to say I would go away and be a politician or work in politics, but I'm curious about that.
I'd put you right off. I'm sure. Okay, and on that, as a sort of final thought, how do you think the UK is placed? Like, in terms of this, like, obviously, Sunak hosted the Bletchley Summit. Like, we've always been at the forefront of a lot of the kind of, like, trust and literacy side of these things over the course of history. But ultimately, we're never going to have the compute power of China or America or, frankly, the capital markets to kind of support it. Where's the UK's position in all this?
So I think the UK has our university system where, you know, we're very strong at training the next generation of scientists or technologists, or, you know, in a world of AI, artists and creative, you know, people and so on. And I think that's a huge asset. The other one is the national health system, right? That, like, having an NHS that caters to every single person. Of course, it's seen as an amazing kind of data treasure, but it's also a way in which we can kind of roll this out and really not just test, but see how it can help people at scale if we kind of play it right. So I think, yes, we might not have the compute or, as you say, the capital markets kind of power to fund the next Google necessarily, but really the second order consequences, which is what I write about too, is what happens with those technologies? Where are they going to go? And how are they going to change society? And there, you know, we have the opportunity, I think, to play a role in kind of how this gets implemented and infused into society. And can it solve some of the kind of big problems we face? Going forward.
That's a brilliant end to it. Maddie, thanks so much for coming on Jimmy's Jobs of the Future. Been a real pleasure. People should definitely check out Codependent. It is Living in the Shadow of AI. It's a really great read and really gets into the kind of like small human questions, which is what you so brilliantly put in the introduction. It's a brilliant read.
Thank you.